Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 614, titled Oleaginous Diplomacy. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians? This has been recorded on October 14th of the year 2007. And as always, let me remind you to supplement the broadcast itself with a vast amount of information available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and linked websites, including the supplemental website, the FTR supplemental website, and the various blogs associated with it, and also WFMU, www.wfmu.org and its vast archives, and the other linked websites, a huge, huge amount of information. Now, we're going to go right back to the major focal point of the broadcast, which is how not only money, basically, matters of business necessity, or what were deemed business necessity, but in particular what was termed oleaginous diplomacy, diplomacy executed specifically in order to gain access to oil rights for oil companies. We're going to take a look at how oleaginous diplomacy led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, how some of the interests involved in that cover-up also figured directly in helping to cast the mold of the modern Middle East, and the enormous troubles that are going on with it, and in turn how some of those same people, such as Alan Dulles, helped to cover up the Nazi genocide against the Jews and others in World War II as something that was deemed to be a matter of business necessity, and also part of the what was viewed as the necessity of having a strong Germany as a bulwark against the former Soviet Union. Now, we've been taking a look at a fellow named Admiral Mark Bristol, who was a bigot, somebody who had no use for the Armenians, he had no use for Jews, but he did feel that it was important for the United States to be on good terms with the modern Turkey of Kemal Atatürk in order to gain access to the petroleum rights that were available within some of the former territories of the Ottoman Empire. And one of the people that he worked with in order to alter policy with regard to investigation and adjudication of the crimes against the Armenians, one of the people that Mr. Bristol worked with was the aforementioned Alan Dulles. It was Alan Dulles, along with his brother and partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, the powerful Wall Street white shoe law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, who, among other things, not only helped to shape the post-World War I world, but also helped to bring about World War II through helping to advise investments into Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and the other powers of World War II. And they then helped to cover up many of the crimes of World War II and helped to set the stage for not only the Cold War, but other events associated with it. And also, one of the things that's interesting about and significant about the Turkish genocide against the Armenians is the way in which it set diplomatic and legal and realpolitik precedents for covering up genocide in the future. Of Bristol's work in helping to cover up the Armenian genocide in order to effect oleaginous diplomacy and the cover-up of the Turkish genocide, and his work with Alan Dulles, we read, turning to, once again, The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by Common Courage Press. Simpson writes of Dulles and Bristol. His, Bristol's, correspondent at the State Department in Washington was Alan Dulles. After the Paris conference, Dulles had served briefly as chief of staff to Bristol, then moved on to Washington to become chief of staff of the State Department's Near East desk, just as oleaginous diplomacy, unquote, was reaching its heyday. Dulles supported Bristol's initiatives. Confidentially, the State Department is in a bind. Our task would be simple, he wrote, if the reports of the atrocities could be declared untrue or even exaggerated, but the evidence, alas, is irrefutable, unquote, Dulles wrote in reply to Bristol's request for State Department intervention with U.S. publishers to shift the tone of news reports still dribbling out of Turkey and Armenia. Again, quoting from Dulles's letter, the Secretary of State wants to avoid giving the impression that while the United States is willing to intervene actively to protect its commercial interests, it is not willing to move on behalf of the Christian minorities, unquote. Dulles went on to complain about the agitation in the U.S. on behalf of Armenians, Greeks, and Palestinian Jews. Quote, I've been kept busy trying to ward off congressional resolutions of sympathy for these groups, unquote. The change in the U.S. government's response to the Armenian massacres presents an acute example of the conflicts that often shape U.S. foreign policy. From 1914 to 1919, the U.S. government and public opinion sharply condemned the Turkish massacres. Ambassador Henry Morgenthau repeatedly intervened with the Turkish government to protest the killings, raised funds for refugee relief, and mobilized opposition to the genocide. A close review of the classified State Department archives of the period shows that much of the government's internal reporting on Turkey was strongly sympathetic to the Armenians throughout the war and the first months after the war. The Western press, too, was overwhelmingly favorable to the Armenians and hostile to the Turkish government. One recent study by Marjorie Hospian Dobkin found that between April and December of 1915, the New York Times published more than 100 articles concerning the massacres when the killings were at their height. All of the New York Times coverage was sympathetic to the Armenians, and most of the news stories appeared on the front page or the first three pages of the newspaper. A roughly similar pattern could be found in publications such as the New York Herald Tribune, Boston Herald, and Atlantic Monthly, and in the journals of various Christian missionary societies. The volume of news coverage rose and fell with events over the next 5 years, but on the whole it remains strongly sympathetic to the Armenians. Yet, a remarkable shift in U.S. media content and government behavior took place as the new Harding administration established itself in 1921. Quote, "Those who underestimate the power of commerce in the history of the Middle East cannot have studied the post-war situation in Turkey between 1918 and 1923, unquote, Dobkin writes, again quoting from Dobkin. "There were, of course, other political factors that proved disastrous for the Armenians, but the systematic effort, chiefly by the Harding administration, to turn U.S. public opinion towards Turkey and away from the Armenians was purely and simply motivated by the desire to beat the rival associated powers to what were thought of as the vast, untapped resources of that country and chiefly its oil," unquote. I'm still quoting, "It is not possible to bring about the desired change in public opinion without denigrating what the Americans had suffered," unquote. She continues, "Retired U.S. Admiral William Colby Chester joined Admiral Mark Bristol as a leading public spokesman for reconciliation with Turkey. Chester was himself not a disinterested party. The Turkish government had granted him an oil concession in Iraq that was potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars." Writing in the influential journal Current History, Chester contended that the Armenians had been deported not to deserts, but to, quote, "the most delightful and fertile parts of Syria at great expense of money and effort," unquote, a claim that went well beyond even what the Kemal government was willing to argue itself. Dobkin reports that missionary leaders such as Cleveland Dodge and George Plimpton, who had once been instrumental in documenting the genocide, began to lend their names to publicity, insisting that the reported Turkish excesses had been, quote, "greatly exaggerated," unquote. By mid-1923, the complex and interlocking challenges created by the demands for justice in the wake of the Armenian genocide on the one hand and the U.S. political and commercial interests in Turkey on the other had been settled in favor of a de facto U.S. alliance with the new Kemalist government. The day-to-day details of the U.S. diplomatic shift in favor of Kemal were handled by Ambassador Joseph Grew, who will reappear later in this narrative as acting Secretary of State during a pivotal moment in World War II, and the chief of the Near East Desk at State, Alan Dulles. The U.S., which had been the principal international supporter of the nascent Armenian Republic, withdrew its promises of aid and protection. Mustafa Kemal soon succeeded through force of arms in suppressing Armenia and in establishing a new Turkish government at Ankara. In July of 1923, the Turks and the European allies signed a new agreement replacing the aborted Treaty of Sèvres with the Treaty of Lausanne. Western governments agreed to new Turkish borders, officially recognized Kemal's government, abandoned any claim on behalf of an Armenian republic, and specifically agreed to an amnesty for all Ittihadists who had been convicted in the earlier genocide trials. As things turned out, many of the top Ittihadists who had fled Turkey in 1918 were eventually assassinated by Armenian commandos. So again, note a number of things. Note how the scramble for oil rights in the old and now dissolving Ottoman Empire basically led to realpolitik, which in turn covered up the genocide against the Armenians. And note how basically it was a relatively cynical process in which, in order to gain access to the petroleum rights, Kemal insisted on certain things. And note how Alan Dulles and other people who were later involved with covering up genocide after World War II or during World War II, note how they got busy doing this in World War I. And note in turn how some of the people involved here were directly involved with things that are very much on the front burner today. People involved with shifting sympathy in the direction of the Turks who owned oil rights in Iraq. So it's a very interesting state of affairs. People like Admiral William Colby Chester, who had an oil concession in Iraq that was worth hundreds of millions of dollars, probably more than that today. And eventually they worked through people like Alan Dulles, through people like Mark Bristol, through people like Joseph Grew, people who also helped to cover up Nazi genocide in World War II. They worked to cover up the Turkish genocide in World War I. And now, basically, the perpetuation of that big lie is something that's very much on the front burner today. I want to note in passing, too, that at this same period of time, Alan Dulles, through part of this oleaginous diplomacy, was helping to shape the creation of Saudi Arabia. It formally came into existence in 1931, but Alan Dulles had worked to help bring that about, along with Jack Filby, a British intelligence operative who was really a double agent for the Nazis. He was a virulent anti-Semite and worked with Alan Dulles, who also worked very closely on behalf of the Nazis through Sullivan and Cromwell and later the Central Intelligence Agency, of which he was director. Alan Dulles worked with Jack Filby and Ibn Saud, the founder of the House of Saud, in order to create, quote, modern, unquote, Saudi Arabia. And to this day, Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm, is the general counsel for Saudi Bin Laden Group, the construction company and largest business enterprise of the powerful Bin Laden family, that are the main construction firm in Saudi Arabia and that basically build the construction or handle construction at the many holy sites of Saudi Arabia. Now later, or earlier I should say, in a number of programs, including For the Record, programs 530 and 578, we've taken a look specifically at Alan Dulles and his role in helping to cover up the crimes of the Nazis and basically help the Nazis spirit their money out of Europe during World War II and then later back into Germany to help sustain the, quote, British, the, quote, economic miracle of Germany at the end of World War II. Recall that it was Alan Dulles who helped to invest Bush family money in Nazi Germany, among other investments, other monies that he helped to invest in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and on behalf of Franco and others. Franco, by the way, the fascist dictator of Spain. Oh, again, I'm going to refer listeners to those broadcasts, among others, For the Record 530, For the Record 578, and many other programs. Just use the search function to on the Spitfire website to locate Alan Dulles, and you can find out more about that. As I'm speaking on October 14th of the year 2007, there's been a fair amount of publicity and a fair amount of general public attention paid to the PBS documentary film series about World War II, The War, by Ken Burns. One of the things that I wanted to go into, we've talked about the Marshall Plan and how it basically helped to sustain the economic and social status quo that existed in Germany prior to and during the Nazi regime. And what we're going to look at next is how really naked, or not naked, but how really cynical and direct the manipulation was on behalf of the architects of the Marshall Plan, and in terms of its goal of perpetuating the German financial and industrial power elite, specifically for the purposes of immediately launching or even sustaining German manufacturing and economic power as part of Cold War policy to create a strong Germany as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. And the Marshall Plan has been represented, and continues to be represented even by relatively knowledgeable, quote, liberal, unquote, sources, as something that led to the flowering of post-war Europe and would lead to the, you know, the rebirth of democracy and the flowering of free commerce, et cetera, which in certain respects it did. But it also basically helped to perpetuate, in many ways, to not only perpetuate the people who were in power and who backed Hitler, but to cement their economic and ultimately political victory as well. And what we're going to look at next is sort of the selling of the Marshall Plan, and really the shaping of the Marshall Plan as a vehicle for perpetuating the economic elite, the financial and industrial elite of Germany that had backed World War II, that had backed Hitler, that had helped to execute the Nazi genocidal policies against the Jews and others, and benefited from the slave labor policies in the concentration camps that were used by the factories owned by many of these people or financed by many of these people. We're going to take a look at the Marshall Plan and just what a cynical process this really was. Now, you're going to see references here to recommendations that were made by a number of people here. One of them is Philip D. Reed, who was the chairman of General Electric, which owned 30% in General German Electric, or AEG, among other companies. That was one of the major firms that was involved with helping to execute Nazi industry and helping to finance Adolf Hitler as well as the workings of the SS. And other people here as well, including a guy named Lewis Brown, who was another Wall. He basically was the head of John Mansville Corporation, and another person who was not only a major industrial magnate in this country, but who lobbied very, very heavily on behalf of the necessity for perpetuating the financial and industrial elite in Germany. Speaking of that effort by the aforementioned General Electric Chairman Philip Reed and Lewis Brown, Reed's company was not an entirely disinterested party. General Electric was among the most important U.S. investors in Germany, owning about 25% of its German counterpart, the electrical giant AEG, plus factories and dozens of smaller interests. At the time Reed was lobbying the U.S. government against antitrust policy in Germany, GE was facing no fewer than 13 criminal antitrust prosecutions in U.S. courts for price fixing, gouging consumers, and the U.S. government through its monopoly on electrical equipment manufacturing, conspiracy, Sherman Act violations, and similar corporate crimes. GE settled most of these cases out of court in 1949, then went on to a series of remarkably similar abuses that in time led to still another round of criminal convictions for senior General Electric executives about a decade later. Next, you're going to see a reference to several names. One is Morgenthau, that's former Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, who lobbied unsuccessfully for the decartelization and demilitarization, even the deindustrialization of Germany itself. A fellow named Herbert Pell, a diplomatic a State Department diplomat, and a longtime associate of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was lobbying for vigorous punishment of Nazi war crimes, and James Stewart Martin, the Justice Department executive official in charge of the decartelization of Germany after the war, and James Stewart Martin, the author of All Honorable Men, the remarkable 1950 book that's available for download for free from the Spitfire website, so please download that book. Of James Stewart Martin and Messrs. Morgenthau and Pell, we read, returning to the splendid blonde beast, as Morgenthau, Pell, James Stewart Martin, and other reformers saw things, the arguments of General Electric and John Mansville had become the dominant point of view in Western policy circles and in the media. They had become standard fare in U.S. newspapers within a year after the occupation began, Martin commented, even though in reality only two steps had been undertaken to implement U.S. antitrust efforts in Germany by the time Brown's denunciation of the program appeared, the seizure of plants and assets of IG Farben, and the appointment of a trustee to administer coal wholesaling firms in the U.S. zone. And again, the arguments here basically for decartelization of Germany and punishment of the criminals in the Nazi regime, including industrialists and financiers, and the opposing viewpoint, leniency or complete exoneration of those same interests in order to begin the post-war rebuilding of a strong Germany as a bulwark against communism. Continuing. The Allies and the Germans both knew that German manufacturing, including war production, had survived the war surprisingly intact, despite the massive Allied bombing campaign. Senator Kilgore publicized a congressional study based mainly on U.S. strategic bombing survey data that concluded that Germany's production of armored cars, fighter bombers, and several categories of strategic supplies had actually increased under U.S. and British bombing, in some cases expanding eightfold over 1942 production figures. True, the air attacks had crippled the German transportation network and oil production during the final months of the war, a telling blow, but that damage was repaired relatively easily once the fighting stopped. From the point of view of oil production, at least, Germany was already, quote, better prepared for war than it was at the end of World War I, unquote, Kilgore contended. Kilgore, by the way, that's Senator Kilgore, who was investigating these things on behalf of a committee, Kilgore stressed that a distinct drift toward post-war accommodation with German business had already set in. Quote, there is a natural inclination on the part of many of our U.S. administrators to take over in order to get things running again, and there is a natural inclination on the part of many Germans to lie back and let them do it. In the desire for efficiency, our military administrators may keep in positions of power the Nazi plant managers, unquote, Kilgore said, again quoting, in Italy, I heard certain American army officers deplore the fact that Italian partisans had killed many of the fascist plant managers, which made more difficult the reorganization of Italian productive capacity. In Germany, there has been no such partisan revolt. The Nazi industrial hierarchy remains intact. The reports of Brown and Reed were in reality briefs for the European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan. Now, these reports, again, of Lewis Brown and Mr. Reed were briefs basically for sustaining the industrial and financial status quo and thereby, to a certain extent, at least the political status quo of the Hitler years in post-war Germany, and defeating the decartelization and also denazification efforts, and vigorous adjudication of the Nazi crimes. Returning again to The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, the reports of Brown and Reed were in reality briefs for the European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan. They illustrate the extent to which that enormously popular and respected program became entangled with the revival of German businessmen who had participated in Nazi crimes. Particularly important in this effort was the Committee for the Marshall Plan, unquote, founded in September of 1947. It labeled itself a citizens' organization, but was in reality funded and administered by the same economic and foreign policy elite that has been discussed thus far. Its initial sponsors included Averill Harriman and Robert Levett, who will be remembered from the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank, Alan Dulles, Dean Acheson, Winthrop Aldrich, chairman of the Chase Bank, Philip Reed of GE, and others of similar stature, most of whom had been active in U.S.-German finance since the 1920s. Labor was represented by hardline anti-communists active in the CIA-sponsored penetration of European trade unions such as James Carey and David Dubinsky. This Marshall Plan lobby operated as a distinguished propaganda committee, as ATT executive Arthur Page described it. Its goal was never described as the revitalization of the German business elite, but rather as saving Europe, unquote, and providing American jobs, unquote, through implementation of the Marshall Plan. But whatever one may think of the plan, the restoration of much of the pre-war German corporate elite was an integral part of the package. General Lucius Clay used the case of Deutsche Bank director Hermann Abst to explain this concept. Quote, We were never able to make Hermann Abs the financial minister of Germany as we would have, unquote, Clay remembered in the same interview quoted earlier, because of the German and American public's refusal to accept a man who had been so deeply compromised during the Hitler years. But not to worry, Clay continued, quote, we were able to finally put him in charge of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was somewhat outside of government, unquote, and which was instrumental in the distribution of Marshall Plan funds for Germany. Sponsors of the Committee for the Marshall Plan were simultaneously at the cutting edge of renewed efforts to invest in German industry. Quote, if you have been trying unsuccessfully to get to Germany to reestablish pre-war business contacts, don't be discouraged, Businessweek told its readers early in 1947. You can expect a program for reviving business in Western Germany to be pushed by all U.S. factions. Republican backing was assured when John Foster Dulles, Republican spokesman, recently called for the revival of business in Germany and Western Europe, whatever the price. German goods are already trickling into the U.S. market. Anticipating some consumer resistance in the U.S., military government authorities have shrewdly met customs requirements by marking them Made in Germany, U.S. Zone, unquote. Before large-scale arrivals of German goods begin, Washington is likely to release a press barrage explaining that the German exports help pay U.S. occupation costs in Germany, unquote. Shortly after its founding, the Committee for the Marshall Plan placed full-page advertisements in the most influential U.S. newspapers, sent thousands of personally addressed telegrams signed by the former Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson to businessmen asking for the donations and political support, and made a mass mailing to hundreds of thousands of U.S. opinion leaders in the upper strata of business, media, labor, and social organizations. The group chartered Marshall Plan clubs in a dozen cities, opened business offices in New York and Washington, and initiated a series of heavily publicized meetings between President Truman and business leaders designed to convey the impression of broad popular support for the Marshall Plan. As Congressman Charles Plumley, a Republican from Vermont, put it, quote, there has never been so much propaganda in the whole history of the notion as there has been for the Marshall Plan, unquote. The campaign created an overwhelming conviction, again quoting, among the American people and among the members of Congress that we must have the Marshall Plan right now, unquote, he continued. The claim of overwhelming support, unquote, was in fact overblown. Public opinion polls of the period indicate that about 65% of the U.S. population either opposed the Marshall Plan or didn't know what it was. Even so, the Marshall Plan passed the Congress by a large margin. The plan sponsored used the relatively broad popular front for doing something constructive about Europe as a means of putting through the distinctly unpopular idea of reestablishing the German economic elite. And that was basically how those precedents were set, a matter of business necessity. And that concludes side two of, for the record, program number 614, Oleaginous Diplomacy, subtitled, Who Still Today Talks of the Extermination of the Armenians, unquote. This program is being recorded on October 14th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.